What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Carrie Kroll is a nurse of over 30 years, a family woman, and a co-victim of murder from Iowa. She found her passion for nursing at a young age and pursued a degree in the medical field out of college. However, it was not long into her professional trajectory that her family experienced a devastating personal loss: the horrific 1996 murder of her sister, Amanda. Carrie is here today to describe all that came next for her family while navigating the criminal justice system for nearly 30 years and the drastic changes they experienced just last year. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly grateful for Carrie's candidness, advocacy, and her willingness to share her sister's memory with our audience.
Hi, my name is Carrie Kroll. I live in Burlington, Iowa. I'm a wife. I'm a Mimi. That's what my grandbabies call me. And I've been a nurse for 30 years. I have a master's in nursing education. I've been a travel nurse. I've been an ER nurse for many years. And for the past 10 years, I have been a school nurse. I have to say that this is probably my very favorite job I've ever had. I love to get to spend my day with kids and just being a little small part of their lives. If I had to say how my loved ones would describe me, probably they would say I'm brutally honest, sometimes too honest. I'm a very social person. I'm not shy at all. I have a great sense of humor. I've come to learn that that is something that you hone as a survival trait when you've been through what we've been through. And I'd say that the most important things to me in life would be my family. My parents were married very young. My dad would always tell the story that he first saw my mom when she was in seventh grade in the hall at school, and he walked up and kissed her. So that was the beginning of their love story, and they were together until my dad died. He joined the Navy when he was 17, maybe 18. They had my brother. When my mom was 18, my dad was 20. And then I came along 2 years later in 1970, and my sister Amanda was born 8 years after I was born. She was the last one, so of course she was a little bit spoiled, but she was always everybody's baby. My parents weren't perfect, but they loved us very much. They worked really hard to provide everything we needed and a lot of things that we wanted. We grew up on a family farm that was right on the border of Iowa and Missouri. So our house was actually in one state and our barn was in another. My brother loves to tell the story that he looked at a survey and my bedroom was in a different state than the rest of the house. We lived on a pig farm, so my dad raised pigs. We had corn, we had soybeans. I can't even describe how big my mom's garden was. My dad's ancestors actually settled that land. They came from Pennsylvania years and years ago. My dad was one of 15 kids. So we always had cousins coming to visit or stay with us. He had different cousins that were farm hands. So we had a huge family and we were all close. Our farm was actually next to my grandparents' farm, and two of my dad's brothers had farms there also. So we all grew up like brothers and sisters, my cousins. In a lot of ways, it was a pretty idyllic childhood. My dad also did custom harvesting. He owned about five combines. You go out west and you cut the wheat for the big farm operations. He did that in the summers in the 80s. So my brother and my cousins would work for him. In the summer, my mom and my sister and I would load up and go out there and stay with them. This was before streaming television, cell phones. There was literally nothing to do. You're in the middle of nowhere. So my mom would drag us to every sod house, every historical marker she could find. So I have really fun memories of my sister and I playing in the camper and trying to find things to do. We fished, we had snowmobiles, we had three-wheelers, we had a pony. We literally were outside all of the time. My mom would actually lock the screen door and she would tell you to find something to do and come back when it was time to eat. It was a great childhood. My sister Amanda was quite a bit younger than I was. We weren't as close as I wish we were. I think that with sisters, you end up growing up to be best friends as they become adults. And my sister and I never got that chance. My brother and I fought a lot as kids. We had a lot of sibling rivalry. We're fairly close now. My brother and my sister were super close. I was the middle child and maybe not as close, but I do have great memories of her when she was a little girl. When she was a baby, she had to sleep in a bouncy seat because she had horrible acid reflux. And back then, that's what you did. So she had to sleep sitting up. And I have some pictures of my dad holding her when they first brought her home from the hospital. And she was the cutest baby, something that I carried with me forever. When I was probably 10, my cousin Shelly and I were babysitting. My mom was out in the pig lot helping my dad. We were supposed to leave all the bedroom doors shut while we were watching my sister. Well, we were playing a game. We left the bedroom door open. My sister went into one of the bedrooms, had a fan cord in her mouth. My cousin went in and grabbed her, and she bit into the fan cord and electrocuted herself. So my sister had a huge scar on her mouth, and she had many plastic surgeries as a child because of that. So I carried a lot of guilt over the years. I felt horrible that I had let that happen to her. I remember going out and telling my mom, there's something wrong with Mandy. There's something wrong with Mandy. And she came running in the house. My parents never blamed me for that, never made me feel guilty or anything. When you grow up on a farm, kids get hurt a lot. We would joke and say we were free range kids. My whole family having a great sense of humor. As adults, we look back and think, Mom, I can't believe you let us do this or let us do that. You look back now about those things and laugh about them, but it's a different time. My mom always went over the top every year at Christmas. So I have a lot of memories of wonderful Christmases. My cousin told me a story recently about one Christmas where my sister unwrapped all of her gifts and didn't tell anyone and then rewrapped them all so no one would know and she knew everything she was getting for Christmas. She was just a fun kid. Always wanted to be a nurse or a teacher. When you're the older sister, your little sister has to be your patients and your pupils. So I have a lot of memories about making her be my playmate. I went to a very rural school in Missouri that was grades K through 12 in one building with the same kids from kindergarten on. It was the best school experience I could have ever asked for. When my brother went to high school, he wanted to play football. Our school didn't have football, so my brother went to high school in Iowa, and my sister and I were still going to school in Missouri, and we all lived in the same house. In the 80s, there was a farm crisis in America. A lot of small family farms were foreclosed on. Unfortunately, ours was one of those. My parents were devastated. They had to watch everything that they owned be auctioned off. Then we ended up moving to Burlington, Iowa, which is where my mom's family lived. Burlington was different because we were exposed to so many more people than what we grew up with. Even things like fast food, we didn't have that. Of course, we had family in Burlington, so we would come here to visit, but it was just a totally different world. Burlington at the time probably had 30,000. Now I don't know how many people are in the city. It's not huge, but it was just a completely different world than what we were used to. My dad became a Teamster and started driving a truck to support our family. Once we moved, my sister's childhood was a lot different than my brother and I. We were used to having a stay-at-home mom and living on the farm, and she spent most of her childhood in town, as we called it. My mom had to work once we moved, and then she decided to go back to school. She ended up going to nursing school and also became a nurse. So it was a different lifestyle than what we were used to. I went into the 11th grade here in Burlington. My sister would have been starting either the second or third grade. I'm not sure which one. And my brother was starting his first year at college at the University of Iowa. My mom always had us in church growing up. That was really important to her. So she put us in a small Christian school here where my cousins went to school instead of the huge high school, which was kind of a blessing for me. I would have been scared to death. I finished high school. I went off to college in Minnesota. I left for college when my sister was 10 years old. The years that she was growing up as a teenager, my college years were early 90s. I don't have as many memories of my sister. I do remember coming home on some Christmas breaks, summer breaks, having some visits with my sister, but those were her teenage years and my early 20s. We weren't as close then. I do remember some serious fights between the two of us. I remember one time I came home to visit my parents. There was a bedroom in the basement of the house. My sister and I both had to stay down there when I would come to visit. Well, my sister's friends had been over and they were all going out for a night on the town and they left all their clothes everywhere. And I was so mad. I put all of their clothes in trash bags and put them on the front yard. I was so hateful and nasty. I can't believe I did that looking back. We kind of butted heads a little bit for those years. I thought I was too cool for school. And here she was just a teenager. Then I came back, went to nursing school. I eventually moved to Chicago after I got out of nursing school. My brother met his wife at the University of Iowa, and he also lived in the suburbs of Chicago. So that's where we both settled. My sister saw people with no judgment. I think that she tried to see the best in other people. She was fun. She was bubbly. And you could say that most of the time she had a smile on her face. Like myself, she didn't put up with any crap. She could stand up for herself, but she had a soft heart. She loved life. No matter what happened to her, she loved people and she loved being a mother. She graduated high school 9 months pregnant. She'd went to an alternative school for that year, but it turned out to be the best blessing that we could have ever asked for, having that child. She was such a good mommy. I can't even tell you. I remember the summer before she died. She came to Chicago with my parents to visit. My brother had had a baby 3 weeks after Mandy did. My parents came to visit with Mandy and the baby. We all did all the touristy things and we just had the best time. And those pictures from that visit, we cherish those pictures. We have a video that we recently watched that was my nephew's third birthday party. That would have been October 3rd of 1996. My sister died on October the 6th of 1996. And she is just doting on my nephew. She's so lovable and sweet. In the video, she's holding her baby. And it's just a video that shows our whole family at this birthday party. And if I could say one thing that I would want Mandy to be remembered by, it was how much she loved being a mother and how good she was at it for being only 18 years old. On October 5th of 1996, I can remember calling home that day. That was the time of landlines. I called home to talk to my mom. My sister answered the phone, and I remember asking her what she was doing that night or that weekend. And she told me that she was going to go to Quincy, Illinois to celebrate a friend's birthday. To my knowledge, she'd never been there before. It was like an hour and a half from where we live. She had a 3-month-old baby, and she'd never been anywhere. She lived with my parents, so they were going to keep the baby for her. So she was pretty excited to have a night out with her friends. That very next day, about mid-morning, my mom called me and said that they couldn't find Mandy. Initially, I wasn't too worried. It was the time before cell phones or tracking. So, of course, you think they're going to show up. But as the day went on, she still hadn't shown up and she's got this brand new baby. You think something's not right. So my brother, my sister-in-law, Jennifer, and I headed home from Chicago. It was about 3.5 hour drive back to Iowa. And I will never forget that drive. There's a payphone on the interstate, which is the last toll booth as we leave Chicago. We stopped at this payphone, got out, and I called home one more time because we thought, let's just call one more time before we get out of the Chicagoland area and make sure she hasn't shown up before we head home. And I feel like that is when I knew. It just had that feeling in my gut that this was not going to end well. Now, anytime I go to Chicago and I go through that area, I feel like it's a trigger. So we get home. My brother and my dad go down to Quincy, Illinois. My mom and I and my sister-in-law, Jennifer, and other family members, we stay home. By the time my brother and my dad got to Quincy, they'd found my sister's body. They're in the police station. They take my dad and my brother into a room. This is all coming from my brother's memory. And they tell him they found her body. My dad wants to see her. And they're holding back. They're like, you don't want to see her like this. They had found her downtown Quincy in some bushes by a dumpster. At the same time, a police chaplain from our town came to our door and informed my mom and I and Jennifer that they'd found my sister's body. My understanding of the night was she's at the party. She went outside to get some air. There's a guy who we now know as Marvin Larry Betts followed her outside. They'd been chatting a little bit at the party, but her friend said not any more than she'd been talking to anybody else. Her friend was outside and remembers seeing her walk around the corner with him, and that's the last time anyone ever saw her. Her friends tried to find her that night when she didn't return, and they couldn't find her, so they got a hotel room. They continued to try to page her. She had a beeper at the time, and no response. The next morning, they knew he had been the last person seen with her. He didn't live in Quincy anymore, but he was in town, so they went to where he was staying. He was packing up his car to leave. They asked him if he had seen my sister, and he said he hadn't. So they called my parents. Marvin Larry Betts didn't know her. He met her that day, a stranger. They found a hatchet in a dumpster next to my sister's body that had fingerprints on it. His prints were on file because he had been arrested once before. He hit her 42 times with a hatchet. He attempted to sexually assault her. He poured lighter fluid on her body, and he tried to light her on fire. Who takes a lighter fluid and a hatchet to a party? I guess you could go get the lighter fluid later and come back, but where was the hatchet? The next few days were just a blur after they found her body. He was on the run. I believe it was 2 or 3 days, maybe. His car broke down in the middle of Utah. A state patrolman pulled over to help him and ran his license. He saw he was wanted for murder and arrested him. He brought him back to Illinois, and he was charged with my sister's murder. We begged for an open casket so we could say goodbye to my sister. But seeing my sister pieced back together was devastating, and you never forget that. Her fingers were cut off. But I feel like if I hadn't seen her, I would never have believed it was her. This is pure evil. How do you rehabilitate that? This murder didn't just affect my family. There were hundreds of people at my sister's funeral, and it affected our whole community. Between October of 1996, May of 1997, there were hearings. There were a lot of court dates that my parents went to. Like I said, my brother and I lived in Chicago, so we didn't attend those, but my parents never missed anything. They were so broken and angry. I mean, who could blame them at that point? After 7 months of preparations for a trial in May of 1997, he pled guilty 6 days before the trial was supposed to start. At the time, Illinois had the death penalty. So the prosecutor did a plea bargain to avoid trial. Betts was sentenced. Now, at the time, Illinois had a law that was called Truth in Sentencing. It was passed in August of 1995. And it required people of certain offenses to serve a set amount of time for their sentence and to serve 100% of that sentence. So before 1995, all sentences were calculated at a rate of 50%. He was sentenced to 60 years, but because of this Truth in Sentencing law, he would have to serve the whole 60 years. no appeals, no paroles, so likely he's going to die in prison. We got to avoid a trial and sitting through hearing what happened to my sister, and he got to avoid the death penalty. We could focus on healing our family and never have to worry about him again. I still lived in Chicago at the time. I didn't attend all the hearings, but I'm telling you, at the sentencing, when you sit across from someone who brutally murdered someone that you love, it's something that you can't even describe. I expected a monster. I felt like I would probably hate him, and I just didn't feel anything toward him like I expected to. I remember thinking, he just looks like a kid. He was 22 years old. How does your life go so wrong that you end up here? At the sentencing, all I remember is he never said a word. He was asked, would you like to say anything? And he said, no, sir. He had an opportunity to say something to my family, and he did not. When we left the hearing, his mother and grandmother came up to my mom and I and said, we just want you to know that we're sorry, and we're praying for you, and we're praying for that baby, and hugged us, which we weren't expecting. I don't think my father would have accepted a hug. He was so angry, and he was always angry after this happened. I don't think that he could ever get over the anger that he carried because of what happened. I guess after the sentencing for my family, the best way to describe how we coped and what happened to us is I tell it like a bomb went off in my family. We were a bunch of broken people just trying to pick up the pieces of our lives. The pain has changed me. It's changed my parents. Years ago, I remember a coworker asked me, why are you so angry? That stuck with me because it made me so sad to think that that's how I'm presenting myself to the world. And I've tried to really work on that because that's not who I am. And I fought really hard to not let the pain make me bitter. I remember just seeing people go about their day like in a McDonald's drive-thru, and I thought, they're living their lives like nothing happened and my whole world is over. You can't wake up every day sad. You can't live your life like that, but it takes a long time for that to happen. I remember telling my mom, every Christmas can't be sad. Every Mother's Day can't be sad. We have to raise this child. But my parents were never the same. I should have come home to help my parents raise the baby, but at the time, I couldn't. I needed to be away. They were drowning in their grief, and I felt like if I came home, I was going to drown too. 2 years after Betts was sentenced, the law that he was sentenced under was challenged, and the Illinois Supreme Court found it to be unconstitutional. So this meant that he was eligible for 50% instead of the 100%. So 2 years after he was sentenced, his sentence was cut in half to 30 years, which meant that he's going to get out in 2027. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of offenders out there that had their sentences reduced under the law change that probably may have deserved it. Not everyone in prison should be there forever, but they just said, oh, by the way, his sentence is cut in half now. Everybody was very angry. How could this happen? You told us that he was going to sit in prison for 60 years, and now he gets out in 30? This was a stranger to my sister, and you brutally murdered her, and you only served 30 years. I don't feel like that's justice. None of my family felt like that was justice. We should have sought resources to help us heal, but it was a different time. We were the suck it up generation. You just get on with your life. You dust yourself off. My parents did go to a support group called Parents of Murdered Children. They went for a little while. And I remember my mom telling me, I go there and I listen to people's stories. And all I care about is my kid. I lost my kid. I could understand where she's coming from. I believe what got my family through this was our faith. My mother always had us in church, and we were raised that way. She relied on her faith in God. I think we all did. But I will say my mom never went to church again. She tried, and it wasn't because she wasn't mad at God. It was because her heart was so broken. And every time she'd walk into church, all she would do was cry. She never lost her faith. And I think knowing my sister was in heaven and she was going to see her again someday is what she clung to. My parents weren't getting any younger. So I did end up moving back to Burlington. That was probably 2000, 2001. I took a job here as a nurse. I came back and got a lot closer to my parents and helped them out more. And then my parents did get sick. Eventually, Amanda's child came and lived with me. So I did end up raising her child. That was a blessing. 2013, my mom was really sick. She was in ICU on a ventilator for weeks. They told us she was going to die, which she didn't. It's kind of a joke. We always say my mom kept clawing her way out of the grave. We have a sick sense of humor in my family, but she almost died numerous times, but she was very, very sick this time. They literally told us she was probably not going to make it. When she woke up, the first thing that she told me was that my sister came and sat on her bed. I cry every time I tell this story. She said she sat on her bed and she said, "Mandy, I could be at peace if I just knew that you were in heaven." And she said, "I'm okay, Mom." And she said, "What's heaven like?" And she said, "You can't even imagine, Mom. You can't even imagine." I get goosebumps and I cry every time I tell that story. Because as a person of faith, I know I get to see my sister again someday. It still hurts me to the core when I think about what it did to my parents. I spent a lot of years taking care of them, and it was really hard on me. My mom left me a letter I found after she died, and she apologized to me because she thought she wasn't a good mother to me after my sister died. But the physical toll that this took on my parents still breaks my heart. The trauma took a toll on their physical health. They were sick for years. Over the last 25 years, I've spent my life just taking care of my family, taking care of my sister's child, doing the best I can to try to do things how she would want things done and try to make her proud. I believe my family did get a lot closer eventually because we all had this trauma that drew us together. And honestly, we were able to put Betts out of our mind. He's locked away. We did hear over the years about different motions that he's filed. He filed motions to withdraw his guilty plea. Actually, 6 months after he was sentenced was the first one. But we just really haven't thought about him. He's been locked away and we haven't had to worry about him. As we knew that 2027 was looming, the thing that I was the most worried about was my sister's child and how this was going to affect their mental health and just dreading the day. But knowing that I had several years left to worry about that. I was in Chicago this summer visiting. My girlfriends and I were going to a concert. It was a little bit of a trigger because I lived there when my sister passed away. So I was kind of mentioning that to my girlfriends and they were asking some questions about what prison he was in. I said, "The last I knew, he was in such and such prison. We're supposed to be notified, but history shows that that doesn't always happen." I got on my phone and I looked it up. I saw the release date said 11/27/24. So I thought, well, that can't be right. He's supposed to have 3 more years in prison. He's not supposed to be released until 2027. When I get back home after the weekend, I called the prison. They give me a caseworker or social worker. He said, "Well, yeah, the last 3 years are parole, and that's considered part of the sentence. So he's going to get out in November." This was, I believe, July. So he's getting out in 4 months. Of course, I had to notify my family. You're not prepared for that. You're thinking you have 3 more years. So that was just really tough. The next few months were really hard to wrap my head around. I can't believe this is going to happen. I can't believe that he's going to be walking the streets. And the thing that I think that stuck with us the most was her child will be 30 years old and this man's going to be walking around free. How is that fair? That's not justice. My sister was 18 years old and she didn't get to live her life. She deserves better than 30 years. So on September the 12th, I received an email from Vine, which is the Illinois Victim Notification System, that said he's going to be released on September 26th instead of November 27th. So again, I call the prison and I'm told that they moved it up because they recalculated for good behavior and because he'd taken some classes. I would say it was probably 2 hours after I received that first email, I get another email. He's being released on September 13th, the very next day. No explanations, no anything, not one word from the prison. No actual person contacted us, just an automated letter from Vine. So we've been re-victimized by the justice system once again. It's like losing my sister all over again. I call the prison. This time, I'm unable to reach anyone. I left messages, I emailed, there was no one else I could talk to for probably at least another week. I finally get a call back from a caseworker approximately a week and a half later. Said, yep, he's released. He got out. Okay, can you tell me anything? The caseworker did tell me he was released for 3 years of supervised release. In the state of Illinois, he does have to register as a violent offender, which he has done. He's got an ankle monitor for 120 days, and he does have to meet with, I believe it's a mental health counselor. So eventually, my brother and I receive a letter that says that we are invited to write a letter to the Illinois Department of Prisoner Review Board that can give our reasons why he should not be released from parole early in the next 3 years. So he could be even released off parole early. I want to mention this man lives down the street from an elementary school. You only have to be 500 feet from an elementary school in the state of Illinois when you're a violent offender. In Iowa, 2,000. I believe in Jesus and I believe in his redeeming blood, but I also believe in justice and we didn't receive it. In my heart, I believe that I've forgiven him. I would never have been able to go on these 28 years had I not forgiven him. I don't share this story for vengeance. It's about justice. I can't walk around with hate in my heart. And it's therapeutic for me to talk about Mandy. Even now, a song will come on or a memory will come into my head. And it literally takes me back 28 years. And I think Mandy should be here. It just comes out in a tidal wave. Every event in her child's life, I feel guilty that I'm the one there instead of her. I cried through high school graduation. I cried through college graduation. I think the thing that people need to understand, the reason that I am sharing this story, this man bludgeoned my sister to death. I've seen the autopsy report. Like I mentioned, he had an opportunity to speak at the sentencing and he said nothing. In 28 years, this man has never apologized or reached out to my family at all. How do we know he's a changed man? The people in his community need to know that he's out there and they need to be careful. I could be putting myself in danger. He is a murderer after all, but I've put protections in place for myself. I feel like it's important that I speak up for my sister, that I can stop him from doing this to someone else. I'm giving myself some grace. It's only been 3 months since the release, but I know I'm going to be okay. I can't change it, so I have to just accept it. I have a great support system, and I know that my faith is going to get me through this. Since this release, I have gone to therapy. My husband suggested it. He saw what happened to my parents' physical health, and he didn't want the same thing to happen to me. My husband, he's a retired firefighter. For him to tell me I need to go to therapy, I'm like, I probably need to go to therapy. I feel like it was a good thing. And I pray that God's going to help me accept what I can't change so I can move on with my life. And I feel like I'm doing that. I just think that things have to change for crime victims and their families. The fact that all we received was an automated email, that's all we deserve after what we've experienced as a family, is ridiculous is the word that comes to mind. I can only speak for the state of Illinois, but you don't get a phone call, a warning, nothing. I also have to say that as an everyday citizen, I think people usually don't pay attention to politics and what's going on in their local government. But in this case, These voters need to know who's representing them. And these violent offenders, letting them out of prison, people are voting for people and putting them in office without even having any idea how they stand on things like that. And I think it's important that you know. If I had to encourage any other victims' families, I'd have to say to share your story. No one's going to advocate for you like you, for your family member. You can keep their memory alive by talking about them. I think a lot of people are scared when you lose a loved one. They're afraid to talk about them to you. But I have to say, for me personally, it makes me happy. I love when people say, oh, I knew your sister. That makes me so happy because she's been gone 28 years. A lot of people in my life now don't know my sister and never knew my sister. So it makes me happy that people remember her and tell me stories about her. So if you have lost somebody recently, I'd say that's my best advice that I can give to you is talk about them. Lean on the people that you love. And if you're a believer, lean on Christ. There's no way around it. You just have to go through the pain. You are never going to be the same again. I will never get over losing my sister. Sometimes when I tell this story, I feel like I'm talking about someone else's life. But my sister was a person, and she deserves not to be forgotten. I don't want to forget her, and I don't want to forget what it felt like to lose her, because she deserves that. I just feel like as long as people are interested in this story, I'm going to share it for Mandy. I can be reached at kariekroll70@gmail.com.
I'm so grateful for everything that you have shared. I feel deeply honored that you would trust me to talk about her with me, but also deeply honored to introduce the audience to Amanda and to your family.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you telling our story more than you know.
This episode is dedicated in loving memory of Amanda Michelle Folker.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I've received two dates. I've received both a 2025 parole date and a 2026 parole date. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to be let out, right? But it does mean that I have to go and make statements again. It does mean that I'm subjected to what we just got subjected to in 2023. It's just a wild process that I don't really have a full grasp on. And that's the what came next of it all, is that it's all still coming next. And I believe there's two hearings coming next. So I have revived the petition that I did take down at one point.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.